Good afternoon, everyone. I'm opening a meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on Tuesday, February 17th, 2015. Welcome. Committee, today we're going to be going through an informational meeting on renewable energy, just an overview on renewables, and we have a few different panels that are going to talk about the different aspects of that. And then we are going to have a public hearing on one of the bills around a solar incentives program. So I'm going to go ahead and open the informational hearing on renewable overview and call up the first panel, which will be Dylan Cruz, Gavin Carpenter, Marty Myers, and Kevin Mass. And we can, do you want to just,
you can pull up one more.
Yeah, you can pull up one more chair. Come up second, that's fine. Okay, great. Thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Can everyone hear me all right?
Mm-hmm. Great. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, sure thing. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Dylan Cruz. I am the Policy Director and Energy Program Associate at Sustainable Northwest, located in Portland, Oregon. Sustainable Northwest brings together stakeholders from rural and urban communities to find solutions to natural resource issues that benefit both people and nature. This includes building a regional economy based on land stewardship, sustainable natural resource use, and clean energy development. It is therefore a privilege to introduce this informational overview on renewable energy in the state of Oregon. It should be no surprise to this committee that Oregon is a national leader in renewable energy policy, implementation, manufacturing, and research. We boast an impressive mix of distributed and utility-scale applications that harness our state's natural resources, including bioenergy, wind, solar, geothermal, microhydro, and wave technologies. These abundant resources provide clean and reliable electricity and heat to our homes, businesses, and public buildings, as well as domestically produced fuel for an evolving modern transportation sector. They create and maintain much-needed and well-paying jobs in both rural and urban communities, reduce demand for imported fossil fuels, keep energy dollars local, improve air quality, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Renewable energy also provide a variety of ancillary benefits to the state that are less often recognized but equally as important. They contribute to sensible and sustainable natural resource use by reducing and eliminating waste and improving the efficiency of forest management, farming, and ranching operations. They also provide opportunities for additional revenue streams and energy independence that improve the viability, security, and well-being of small and large businesses and communities across the state. Today, we're joined by an excellent lineup of leaders in the renewable energy sector that are here to discuss the successes and challenges they have experienced in this pioneering work. We've made significant progress in recent years to expand the use of clean, renewable energy, but we still have tremendous immediate and long-term needs and opportunities for Oregon to build upon this foundation. The legislature and this committee will have many opportunities this session to review and debate existing and proposed renewable energy policies. We would like to thank this body for the commitment and support it has already demonstrated to position Oregon as a leader in the renewable energy economy. We also recognize the important financial and budgetary considerations that the legislature faces as they consider these recommendations. With this in mind, we respectfully request that you prioritize opportunities for continuation and expansion of smart and effective renewable energy policies, as well-placed investments in the future of Oregon, people, businesses, and landscapes. So I'd like to express my appreciation once again for the invitation to introduce this panel and to recognize the speakers that have joined us here to present on this critically important work. I'm confident they will be able to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Gavin Carpenter. I'm Director of Sales with Sequential Biodiesel. We have Oregon's largest and longest running biodiesel facility about 6 miles from here. We produce about 6.5 million gallons of biodiesel per year from used cooking oil. We collect from 8,000 restaurants in Oregon, Washington, and California. We employ about 83 full-time employees. They all receive medical and dental benefits, and they earn living wage jobs. And we currently have over 60 retail locations offering 20% biodiesel blends in Oregon. I want to touch on two things. Number one, a quick summary of the national biodiesel industry, and then address a couple initiatives that have happened in Oregon. Nationally, the biodiesel industry has been encumbered by, you know, very erratic policy at the federal level. This may come as a shock, but it's a little bit rusty in Washington, D.C. And we've had a lot of issues with credits turning on and off, credits turning on and becoming retroactive. And we've also had indecisive leadership with the Environmental Protection Agency regarding the National Renewable Fuel Standard and an unwillingness to set a firm renewable volume obligation. That's really affected the biodiesel industry nationwide. It's prohibited growth, prohibited investment. We focused and we feel it's absolutely critical that we develop effective policy at the state level, and there's really been three initiatives in Oregon that have had a significant impact on the regional biodiesel industry. In 2011, you actually enacted the 5% renewable fuel standard, so all diesel sold in Oregon has 5% biodiesel in it. You know, many of the concerns we heard in 2011 are the same concerns we're hearing right now about the Clean Fuels Program. There's not enough supply. Prices are going to go up 30 cents a gallon. Those statements were all unfounded and untrue. Biodiesel still sells for about 45 cents per gallon below petroleum diesel. The second policy is the tax forgiveness bill, which came into effect last year. That's helped us expand our retail outlets that are offering 20% blends of our biodiesel from used cooking oil. You know, it's really been a monumental step, not just in the additional vehicles running it, but really we've got tens of thousands of vehicles that are running 20% biodiesel. And it's what's not being said that's been impressive, because we're looking at a lot of vehicles that have proven they can run higher blends. They're not massive vehicles being towed to mechanics or to dealerships to be repaired. So it's been a nice proving point for us. And the third one, obviously, is the Oregon Clean Fuels Program. I've had the privilege of being on the Governor's Advisory Task Force and the DEQ Rulemaking Committee. The Rulemaking Committee had a lot of people from both sides, including some of the oil suppliers who are actually our customers. And I'd just like to say that, you know, they provided quite a bit of significant input in this policy. Two specific suggestions they provided was, number one, that reduce the paperwork on the regulations for compliance, and number two, reduce the on-off switch that DEQ had originally put into the plans, which, again, gets rid of some of that uncertainty around the market. So, and the final thing on the Governor's Advisory Task Force, the recommendation that came out, well, there's a couple recommendations, but the most important one was putting a cap on what these credits can trade for. And that's a very strong insurance policy for consumers, because if, you know, the renewable fuel industry decided all shut down for maintenance for 6 weeks and those prices ran up, that would put an insurance mechanism for the consumers. And it's, you know, a good and protective measure for all the drivers out there. So, you know, the Clean Fuels Program is written by Oregonians for Oregonians. And it's going to position us at the forefront of the robust clean fuels industry for years to come. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for this panel? Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate you being here. Could you talk about tax credits and or subsidies for the biofuel industry? What currently do you receive, and how much do you need to receive in order to be able to compete on a level playing field?
Currently, Vice Chair Johnson, currently there are no, there's not a national biodiesel tax credit in place. It came through in December and was actually retroactive to last year, so there's no federal excise tax in place. There's Oregon's tax forgiveness program, which waives the state road tax of 30 cents a gallon for retailers who offer a 20% blend of biodiesel. So it's the retailers who get to choose whether they want to charge the state road tax of 30 cents, drop it 10 cents, 20 cents, whatever it is. So that, again, is something that doesn't come directly to sequential. So the only program out there is a National Renewable Fuel Standard, the RFS, which is the Renewable Identification Numbers. And those are credits that we generate on our product, and we sell those to obligated parties.
Thank you.
Representative Polpe.
Thank you. I'm curious about your looking into the future, your feedstock for biodiesel. Is it stable, increasing, more demand, or do you think about changing your feedstock?
We're, as mentioned, we're collecting for about 8,000 restaurants, and we can use any type of used cooking oil, but we've actually developed the technology to take a grease trap waste, which is a really unpleasant aroma of product as it come out of the restaurants, and we can actually get the oil from there. And whether it's oil, there's energy, and we'd like to go collect that. So that's another technology we'd be looking to invest in and develop. And then there's some ones a little bit far out there getting algae oil, and those are the primary ones that we'd be looking at.
Okay, thank you very much for coming today. So let's go ahead and have Marty Myers and Kevin Moss come up, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Vega Peterson, for allowing us to talk to you today, you and your committee members. We do have a presentation that we've brought along with us. You know, we're talking about biomass tax credits.
Oh,
and
can you please introduce yourself for the
I'm
record,
sorry.
Please? That's
I'm
okay.
Sorry.
And members, the presentation is also available on OLIS.
Okay. I'm Marty Myers, General Manager of Three Mile Canyon Farms. And Kevin, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Kevin Moss, President of Farm Power.
So, you know, we're here talking about biomass tax credits and anaerobic digesters that use manure as a fuel source. We're we've had a digester at Three Mile Canyon Farms now in operation for approximately 2 years. It's working well, and the value of the biomass tax credits to this type of project are enormous. And one of the major decision-making issues that we had was relying on that for the huge capital investment we made on that project. The incentives for the biomass tax credit has provided for an expansion of renewable energy projects in Oregon based on performance rather than capital invested in the project. So even though we use the biomass tax credit revenue as part of our revenue stream in the analysis of whether to invest, we took all the risk of completion at the dairy level. So the state doesn't have a risk of completion in this program. The invested, you know, the business has invested in the facilities and taken the all the risk of operation out of the state's hands. Credits are earned based upon performance. So that is, I think, one of the strengths of the program. The program has had successes in creating renewable energy in rural communities, and I think Kevin will talk about his projects that are very successful in Tillamook County. We're on the east side of the mountains in Boardman, Oregon, and even though the bill was originally intended to stimulate activities in the woody biomass area of energy production, you know, manure digesters were included in the original bill. The woody biomass activity increased significantly in 2010 and 11, but it's been on a decline in 2012, so I think we need to address those issues in any new legislation. Generation from anaerobic digesters has increased during that same period. So as far as Three Mile goes, you know, Three Mile is a piece of land that's 93,000 acres in the Boardman area of eastern Oregon, approximately 145 square miles. Through a series of settlement agreements, we set aside 23,000 acres in a conservation area for upland habitat, and we restricted our water withdrawals from the Columbia River. So we today farm about 40,000 irrigated acres, and we have about 1,000 acres that we can further develop. I've given you kind of what we grow here. The only thing I'll point out is that we are a large organic farmer now. There's no coincidence there. I'll show you the graph of organic farming increases over the period of years. We started milking cows in 2001, and we therefore had the fertilizer in 2002 to start organic farming. That's been a major part of our business growth, and we've incorporated dairy farming into organic farming over the years. Another point that dairy farming has created the opportunity for the anaerobic digester, and we're presently producing about 4.5 megawatts of electricity every hour, and which turns out to be about 40,000 megawatts per year. We think we can increase that production over a period of time. We've been ramping up over the last 2 years, and we're consistently hitting that number now. And this is reliable power. We produce every hour of the day, just like cows are milking and producing milk every hour of the day, 365 days of the year. So, moving ahead a little bit, I think it's important that we talk about the Dairy Air Task Force that was formed many years ago, and we evaluated what was good for the state of Oregon and how could we address environmental concerns about air quality in the state that was created, issues created by the dairy industry. And one of the BMP's best management practices that were recommended was put in manure digesters. So, and the reason for that was it reduces the greenhouse gas emissions. Methane is 23 times more damaging than CO2 emissions. And we're capturing that methane now and creating electricity and emitting CO2. So we've had a significant impact on greenhouse gas emissions. It also reduces odors from dairies, reduces the solids of manure by 30 to 40%, similar to composting, but we're getting the benefit of electricity, and it creates renewable energy. So I've given you a few pictures here of what our digester looks like, and it was a significant financial investment. The cost of a digester is $1,200 to $1,500 per cow. That what we spent on our digester was approximately $31 million, and it takes a long time to pay that type of investment back, but it provides a lot of benefits. So I think I'll turn it over to Kevin and let him tell you a little bit about Farm Power, unless there's questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Moss. I'm the president of Farm Power. We are a third-party digester developer owner operator. That means we lease land from farmers in Tillamook County, where we have built two manure digesters. Those take manure from six different dairy farms, small and medium-sized dairy farms in Tillamook County, process it, send it back. That's about 5,000 cows there in Tillamook County. We generate about 1.5 megawatts of power and sell it to the local PUD and to Pacific Corp. We make a long-term investment in Tillamook County because we see that we can make money off of electricity. We see that the dairy industry there is stable. And we also see that the government of Oregon is committed to the success of digesters. That's why I'm here today. I want to tell you that programs like the biomass tax credit have been very important to us deciding to invest right about $10 million in Tillamook County. And we really hope that that program can be extended in a transparent and a fair manner, something that we can count on for years to come. We don't ask the dairy farmers we work with to put any money into the operations. They've got enough to deal with there in Tillamook County. So what we have done is, you know, we lease ground and process their manure, but we make sure that the farmers save money, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, whether it's on bedding or manure processing costs. So an ongoing tax credit helps us continue to operate, even though we are, in a way, leaving money on the table or letting value pass to the dairy farmers that we work with. So I encourage you to take a look at the biomass tax credit and see what you can do to extend it in a way that works for all stakeholders and lets us continue to count on it for many more years. I would love to take questions.
Questions for this panel? Representative Reardon.
So if you didn't have the tax credit, how much would you be paying your capital cost per cow?
Well, the tax credit sort of subsidizes our operations. The capital cost per cow that Marty referred to, we're probably a little higher than that because we're doing smaller digesters. So we invested maybe around $2,000 per cow to start out, and we borrowed money to do that, and we got some grants and we put equity into it. On an ongoing basis, we file for the biomass tax credit in order to help us operate and in order to deliver value to the farmers.
And we'll be talking more about the biomass tax credit when we come up. It's going to be coming up for a public hearing in a couple of weeks as well.
Chair Vega Peterson, if I could make one more comment. We are willing and able to work with the Department of Energy, the committee, and all the stakeholders in this, including environmental groups and woody biomass, to make any extension of the bill or modifications to the bill a success. So we're open to comments and recommendations.
Thank you. I'm sorry, do you have a question?
Yes, Representative Benson.
Thank you. So if you weren't using the digester, what would happen? What would happen to the manure if you didn't have the digester?
Well, Chairman Vega Peterson, Representative Bentz, if we hadn't made the investment, we would have been composting all the solids. We would have been spending hydrocarbons and emitting CO2 for all the equipment that it takes to do all the composting. But the waste was handled properly. It was applied to fields at agronomic rates, and the liquid waste was put through our center pivots, our irrigation system, as fertilizer to organic crops. So that really hasn't changed. What we're doing with the digester is we're taking a product that we basically beat to death out there in the composting area. Any methane that was associated with that product was emitted into the air. What we're doing now is processing that, capturing the methane, reducing greenhouse gases, creating electricity, turning what is some view as a waste product into a value product.
Representative Perry. I'm sorry, did you have a follow-up?
I have a follow-up, if I may.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So do we have some numbers? It's one thing to say there was a lot of methane going into the air, now there isn't. Do we have the numbers of how much? Will you be presenting those to us?
I can certainly do that, yes.
Thank you.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Bentz, we have verified the carbon offsets from several of our projects, so we have hard numbers that we can share. It's roughly 4 tons of carbon dioxide avoided per cow that runs through a digester. So our Tillamook projects are probably avoiding about 20,000 tons a year.
Thank you.
Representative Heard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it true that the methane that you're producing can be at some point refined, purified, however you'd say it, to where if you had a fleet of trucks close by, you could actually produce an actual cleaner burning renewable fuel source, better that, if, as I've understood it, it burns cleaner than propane, but you can use it for properly outfitted semi-trucks and whatnot? Is that true?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hurd, I'm certainly not an expert in that area. I do have some knowledge of a Midwest digester that creates a renewable fuel like you're talking about. I believe it's LNG that they're producing, and they have a fleet of milk trucks that they fuel. So the critical attribute there is that you have fueling stations along those routes so that they have a reliable source. But yes, you could create a renewable fuel out of this methane gas.
Right. Follow up. And I guess my point is that a facility such as yours can potentially serve multiple benefits, not just feeding the grid electricity-wise, which, at least in my limited knowledge, makes it such an interesting project. Something worthwhile.
Yes, we do have options. It all gets down to economics and what's the most viable economic return in the short term, that we make the investment. Electricity seemed the most viable option that we had at the time of construction.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hurd. I think we're very, very happy to have invested in Tillamook County because these digesters will last 30 years or longer, mm-hmm. and we don't know what the future holds. Our power contracts are for 15 years. In year 16, we may very well be looking at other alternatives.
Right.
Thanks for moving so quickly. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you so much for joining us today. Okay, next I'm going to call up Ferris and Sam Littlefield, and I'm sorry if I butchered your name. Please have a seat, and when you're ready, you can just remember to state your name for the record.
You want to go first?
Feel free.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. My name is Rob Ferris, and I am Executive Vice President of Ferris Lumber Company, and we have a wood-fired cogeneration plant called Evergreen Biopower in Lyons, about a half an hour east of here. And if any or all of you would like to come see it, it's running 24/7, and be happy to give you a tour. Our company was founded in 1922, and we powered a small sawmill on biomass from the inception until the dams came in the early 50s near Detroit. And at that time, we took our cogen plant out, and in the mid-2000s, natural gas got up to $14, and we had residuals from our veneer and lumber manufacturing plant, so we put in a 10-megawatt generator and a 100,000-pound boiler. We only needed about 30 or 40,000 pounds of steam to dry our veneer. The Business Energy Tax Credit was completely responsible for us building a much larger boiler, which required a dozen employees, and the smaller boiler would have required none. And we sell electricity to the grid and provide steam for our drying and processing in our veneer plant. In hindsight, we're natural gas is at $4 today. It doesn't look like it was as good of an investment as we'd hoped, but it does give us an option. We have a 10-year contract that expires in 3 years, and at that point in time, the utilities pay an avoided cost rate, the cost of building a facility, and that would be based on natural gas prices, which today are about half of what we're being paid. We're being paid about 6.5 cents, where all of our residential bills are 10 or 11 cents, 12 cents, something like that. And at that point in time, we will have the decision to turn off the turbine, and we could lay off the 12 people that we work in the plants. Plus, we have folks in the woods bringing us fuel, bringing us and processing it and transporting it to the plants. Alternatively, we may put in a transformer and run our plants on and come off of the grid. That's another alternative. Before the legislature, at this time, there's a bill 2449, House Bill 2449, which provides a production-based tax credit that is really essential for existing plants that aren't running to begin operation, and for plants like ours to continue to operate. And I encourage you to support that bill. As I mentioned, the Business Energy Tax Credit was absolutely essential for us to add the capacity and the employment that we did at the time of our construction. There is a transportation tax credit to bring material out of the woods, and it's at $10, I believe, and it would be more greatly used if it were $20. That material is very low value and high cost to bring in and to process and to get to the plants. Our plant has run continuously. We've been able to run without, say, 85 or 90% of the time, as opposed to solar, which it's daylight half the year, and wind power operates about 30% of the time. So biomass is firm power and highly valued by the utilities. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ferris, how much does it cost to get it out, the biomass resource out of the woods. If 10's not enough.
You know, the Oregon Forest Resources Institute did a study and said it was about $45 per ton. That would be a green ton, and the biomass tax or the production tax credit is $10 at the present time, and I believe it's and $20 would help a great deal in getting it to the plant.
Follow up, but it's still not the 45. So
no,
is it?
Well, it's. I mean, it's.
Does it work for you to do that? I mean,
we were buying about half of our supply from the woods, and Weyerhaeuser had a particular contractor that was working on their lands, and they discontinued offering them the opportunity. And so we've gone more to urban wood. We have a fleet of trucks, and we ship about 250 to 300 truckloads of wood chips to paper mills. And so we'll go up to Longview or down to Springfield and take a load of chips up, and then on a backhaul come through town and pick up urban wood, and that will reduce the cost of the haul. And so we have that unique advantage that others would have to go to the woods and back, and only be, it'd be a one-way haul. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Benson. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in looking at this situation over in the John Day area and trying to figure out how to make it work and pay for all that freight of bringing the material out of the forest, it appeared that we needed to be looking at other benefits that were accruing to the forest that weren't paying their share of that freight. And so I can share with you what we determined were benefits that were not being appropriately charged, if you will, for the good that comes from bringing that stuff out of the woods. Before I launch into those, what are they? And when this stuff comes out of the woods, what's the good that inures to society in general?
Well, the material that's left in the forest or is rotting in the forest is emitting methane, and that gas is considered 20 times more harmful than CO2. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. We have million-acre fires. I mean, and the amount of emissions coming off of these fires is so much greater than what is, if you can put it into a power plant such as ours. The only pollution control equipment we have, because it's so clean, is an electrostatic precipitator, which is just taking the fine particles out of the stack. We're reusing the steam and bringing the emissions back into the boiler, and so there are a number of societal benefits that derive from the use of removal of this ingrowth. Our forests are presently very overstressed because of ingrowth and a lack of management on especially on federal forests, and they're causing infestations when these trees are competing for water and light and nutrients. And then lightning or man-caused fires, we're seeing millions and millions of acres burning up across the United States. You know, an interesting fact, back in 20 years ago when harvests were discontinued in Pacific Northwest on Forest Service lands, the environmental community was concerned with 66,000 acres a year being clear-cut. Well, that's about 2% of the forest land in Oregon and Washington. Well, I should say 1%, and we've lost far more than that to forest fires. I mean, we've had a 500,000 acre biscuit fire. There was 300,000 acres burned in eastern Washington last year. The B&B fire was 100,000 up by Mount Jefferson, and numerous smaller fires. And so the lack of management has contributed to the severity of the fires we have today, and removing some of that fuel from the forest would reduce the chance of loss of life and the and improve the health of the forest.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So, and I think there's some other benefits in addition to those you just listed, but the challenge isn't so much identifying the benefits, which I'm happy you did, but it's finding the people to pay for them, because the tax credit is one thing, but it's too modest to pay the freight of getting all of that out of the woods. And therefore, as we learned in the John Day area, you have to go to the federal government and to others and say, hey, if you want this to continue, we've got to find the money somewhere. And I think we've been working on a collaborative group over there that I think has got some, we hope, 10 to 20,000, 50,000 acres, we hope, under contract for, quote, treatment that will generate some of the benefits. But we're still stuck with this, how do we get that stuff out of the woods? And so I think one of the challenges for this group and others here is figuring out how to make sure that those benefits that are accruing to society in general are paid for.
You know, this House Bill 2449, if you pay the person that's going to burn the material enough, they'll pay the freight.
If. Yeah. If.
It. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ferris, thank you for being here, and really hats off to anybody who's survived in the lumber mill business. As you have. I guess my question is, though, regarding the economy and efficiencies, and, you know, how does it really pencil out for the state of Oregon to issue subsidies or tax credits to enable this type of biomass, cogen or whatever, to generation of electricity to continue at a time when the commodity is so low, you know, when natural gas prices are at historic lows, and you know, frankly, the supply looks like it's going to stay that way for quite some time. How is it in Oregon's best interest to continue to extend these type of tax credits so that people can be paid to bring the commodity to you so you can create the energy and so forth, rather than just converting back to a cheaper source of fuel?
These plants are providing, say, the tax credit that I received, it's provided a dozen jobs in the plants, maybe two dozen jobs at least in the woods, along with transportation jobs. I think the state sees a return on its investment through income tax revenue from each and every person that's employed in that process. We have a real severe problem in Eastern Oregon and Central Oregon with poverty and all of the social ills that have resulted from the discontinuance of timber harvesting, and the opportunity to say thin our forests and make them more healthy, bring in the material for solid wood and store that carbon for 50, 75 years and cause the forests to add carbon and release oxygen is an ecological benefit. And I understand that I understand that, you know, tax credits were slashed in the 2008-2009 period, and business as a whole has had those benefits taken away and those incentives to come to Oregon and build. And I know our company could build another cogen plant and add that much more employment at our plant in Mill City, and but without that production tax credit or the business energy tax credit, it doesn't pay because of the low commodity price. But there is the, you know, there's an abundant supply of that material, and it's just there for the processing.
One quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
And I hear what you're saying, and I appreciate that, but I guess, again, It just seems like we're playing small ball or grasping at straws trying to compensate for a generation of federal forest mismanagement. I'd love you to build another mill to create 2x4s and 2x6s, which are the ultimate way to sequester carbon, right? Mm-hmm. To put it into a house or put it into a structure that's going to provide some benefit instead mm-hmm. of simply grasping at straws so we can burn whatever residues laying on the forest floor. That's the ultimate best good for those products, and I think you would agree with me.
Yeah.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're looking to do that.
Representative Weiner.
Representative Johnson was kind of getting where I was going to go with my question. And you may have the answer to this, you may not, but my question, Rob, would be, I mean, we need to get more serious about this, and you generate a lot of biomass just by the process of harvesting the timber, sawing the timber, making plywood, making 2x4s and everything. If we aggressively went after our federal delegation and the revenue that would come in for our schools and everything just off the lumber, and then the jobs, you could create probably a lot more jobs if we had whole logs coming into your plant, would you not? And
certainly.
What would the amount be to keep your cogen plant up and running that you would need? How much more production? Have you ever ran those numbers? And then the cost of hauling would be changed tremendously.
We have roughly half of our needs coming off the log as bark, planer shavings, sawdust, ply trim. The other half we purchase, or we'd either get it out of the woods or we get it out of urban sources at our 10 megawatt facility. At our plywood mill, we'd use the equivalent of about 6 megawatts or 60,000 pounds of steam. And so, given it just depends on how large a plant you want to build. I mean, you can build 50 megawatt or more cogeneration facilities if you are certain that you can get the supply. And the Forest Service is trying to increase the pace and scale of their projects because they're hung up with so much paralysis by analysis, doing their environmental impact statements and those sorts of things. And so if they do larger projects over a longer period of time, like the one in Eastern Oregon that's 10 years in length, that gives investors a reason to invest that, yes, we have a source of supply for an extended period of time. So these stewardship contracts have started out as a pilot. They were permanently enshrined in law in the Farm Bill this past February, I believe it was, a year ago. And they've grown to more than a third of the contracts across the United States where they exchange goods for services, meaning they'll exchange timber and biomass products for building roads and putting in culverts and improving the environment. So there's some opportunity to increase the size of the supply and to manage the forest, too.
I could follow up.
Follow up.
Because the thing that kind of spawns this is, and something we could look back to in history, is the Tillamook burn. Mm. So when that happened, because I remember then that's when the Depression was going on, and they hired, I mean, there were men that were hired from all over that would go out there and replanted millions and millions of trees that weren't there before after the burn came through, and now we're seeing the benefit. Most of that's private ground, state ground. But the harvest and everything, we're receiving those benefits now. And I think it's something we really need to be aggressive. And I don't know if your company or if you guys have access to studies of what's going on with federal forests, because I do a lot of hunting out there. My family actually benefited with the logging of the Tillamook burn and everything as well. But stuff we could do to really put pressure on the federal delegation to start open up, because the federal forests are some of our worst mismanaged forests in the state, and we need to really do something about it and be aggressively going after them.
You know, the Tillamook burned four times, 6 years apart like 39, 45, 51, and 57, something like that. And don't think that the west side can't burn, because the entire Coast Range burned in 1830, 1860, 1890, and the Tillamook burn in the mid 20th century. So it's not immune from a lack of management to go up in smoke.
Thank you so much. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Sam Littlefield. I'm a development project manager with EDP Renewables, and despite degrees in forestry, I'm actually here to talk to you about the wind industry today. So EDPR is the third largest renewable energy operator, wind farm operator in particular, globally. In the U.S., we have over 31 projects generating over 4,000 megawatts. EDPR has three projects in Oregon. We've got two in Gilliam and one in Union that were constructed from 2007 to 2009. So at about 300 megawatts total, that brings us to nearly 10% of Oregon's 3,400 megawatts of operating wind farms. EDPR itself has invested over $600 million in capital expenditures, so the wind farms themselves. Since 2006, we've also paid out over $75 million to landowners and vendors with Oregon addresses. That doesn't count absentee owners and contractors based out of state, as well as paid over $16 million in property taxes. In addition to the operating portfolio, we also have a development stage portfolio of projects mostly in the Gorge region and eastern Oregon. The wind industry as a whole has invested over $7 billion in Oregon. It includes over $100 million in construction, payroll, $8 million in annual wages, another $8 million in annual land and lease payments, and then $110 million in public revenue. Most of the wind energy generation that's been installed to date in Oregon has been compliance-driven, with the renewable portfolio standard being the primary driver. I'm sure you're all well aware that the next target is 20% by 2020 and then 25% by 2025. The utilities are long. They've been pretty active in procuring electricity. We don't expect significant new procurement in the wind space for utility-scale wind anyway until later this decade. Most of the utilities are operating with existing wind farms and then banked renewable energy credits. But nationally, we're seeing an interesting trend. Most notably, there's been a precipitous decline in the installed cost of wind energy, as well as a significant increase in the efficiency of wind energy, and that's been one of the main procurement drivers. That's particularly the case in some of the windier, more energetic markets like the Midwest and the Rocky Mountain Front Range states. Those utilities, Xcel is a great example, they're buying wind because it's cheap, really cheap, and price certain. Of course, that's taking advantage of federal production tax credit, which technically expired at the end of 2014, but it has effectively a sunset of several years out as long as you've had significant investment by the end of 2014. And that's worth approximately $23 per megawatt hour, or 23 cents on your utility bill for the first 10 years. So roughly a $20 value add per megawatt hour. That sounds significant, but I think, you know, the U.S. Energy Information Administration has compiled some statistics of late that make wind, even absent the PTC, pretty compelling. They're starting to look at 2019-plus cases. Most of the renewable portfolio standard state-level RPSs that have driven procurement have a 2020 benchmark on them. Most of those utilities are going to be procuring late in the decade, so looking at 2019-plus. As an industry, we don't really expect a full-value production tax credit extension again. We're not even necessarily asking for one, and that's certainly not what I'm here to do at a state hearing. But they're putting wind power prices at around a levelized cost, 25-year levelized cost, around $70. That's only marginally higher than the installed cost of new combined cycle gas generation, and it's significantly lower than the cost of combined cycle gas generation with carbon sequestration technology. Of course, wind does not produce carbon emissions, and again, is price certain and not subject to fuel price risk. I would also say, you know, I mentioned $70, combined cycles around $60, with sequestration it's at $85. I mean, we're seeing prices in the Midwest, again, Xcel's a great example, where they're levelized contracts, 20-year contracts at $20 a megawatt hour. Now, that includes a production tax credit, but still, you know, even if you take the PTC out, you're looking at $40, $45 a megawatt hour. It's cheap. It's cheaper than new build gas. And I think that it's a really exciting time for the industry. I'm really happy it's the first time I've been to one of these hearings where I've not come with a specific policy ask. I'm here to say thank you, and also to say, you know, please keep an open mind as we explore policies that are more regional in nature. I think that Oregon has a great ability to build new wind, gain new investment, to use that electricity locally, also to export that electricity, and maybe even more importantly, the opportunity to import cheap wind energy from some of the more energetic areas that are connected to our market through the Bonneville system and other areas. I guess with that, I'd say thank you and happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the balancing issue on wind has been the question, and the capacity of the Bonneville system to be that balance has been, as I understand it, exhausted. Is that correct, or is there still capacity there for more balancing? And if not, what's the alternative?
Well, I think it depends on the year. I think this year will be an interesting year. Several years ago, we were told that, oh, you're generating too much wind. We have surplus hydro. We need to spill the dams. This year, you know, with our hydro resources being strained, that may be more challenging, but I don't view that as being a significant risk to the industry, certainly not currently installed capacity. You know, we're regionalized. There are new initiatives, including a regional imbalance market run out of PacifiCorp that has the opportunity to help handle some of the I guess I'll say inter-hour variations, but you know, gas is part of the solution. I'm not suggesting that, you know, wind is going to come in and generate all of our electricity. Balancing will continue to be an issue, but it's one we're solving through a combination of geographic diversity, new technological improvements, battery storage, of course, our legacy hydro, which is one of the best battery storage systems globally. So, I guess no.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
The question, I guess, is the additional cost as a result of the need for balancing. So in the numbers you were giving us, mm-hmm. did that incorporate those balancing costs?
It's a good question. The $70 price tag does. The $20 price tag I mentioned for new build, levelized cost, 25-year contracts coming out of the Midwest doesn't necessarily incorporate those costs. But the system costs are maybe somewhere between $5 and $9. So you're still markedly cheaper than what you're seeing from new build gas-fired plants.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Oh, sorry. Vice Chair Johnson.
Sorry, got in late. I'm sure you're probably aware of the one draft piece of legislation that would move Oregon's, remove us off of any coal derived power by 10 years, let's just say, so that all electricity that comes into Oregon would have no coal residuals whatsoever. Is the wind energy industry capable of picking up that slack within a 10-year period of time?
Yes. When I look at Montana, Wyoming, the resources that we've explored in those areas, gentleman to my left mentioned that we're looking at like 30% capacity factors for wind. Montana, we're looking at 50% capacity factors for wind. It's a much more robust resource. We've got the wires in place to deliver that electricity already, and we have abundance of natural gas coming out of our northern Rocky Mountain and Dakotas that could certainly serve new build gas that would help complement those resources. But I would also say that with geographic diversification of wind in our region, in some of those Rocky Mountain states and elsewhere in our market, plus solar, that full complement gets us to a very low carbon grid where coal can be drawn down and eventually eliminated and replaced by gas for the backfill and storage.
Quick follow-up. Would you have any idea what the impact of the consumers would be?
It's not something that I'm probably qualified to discuss. I'm more of a nuts and bolts guy. But I'm sure there's folks with our advocacy organizations that will help to run those numbers and provide them to you shortly.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So the next panel we're going to bring up is Bill Eddy, Paul Israel, and Alex Sifford. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. My name is Bill Eddy, and I'm a president and co-founder of One Energy Renewables, which is we're actually headquartered in Seattle with office in Portland. Do I drive the slide here with the right?
Yes.
Okay. So we're an early stage developer primarily of solar projects, larger scale projects, multi-megawatt utility scale solar. We work around the country. We work in the Northwest. We also work in Texas and parts of the Northeast. We have some other related business lines, but that's our primary focus. And that means we are identifying markets that we like for solar. We're doing deals with landowners. We're doing permitting and getting projects ready to build and financed. So my presentation, I wanted to give sort of national perspective on the solar market, drill a little bit into Oregon, but mostly defer the Oregon conversation to the gentleman to my left, Mr. Israel. So with that, it's a very ambitious time and a great time in the solar business. There's a lot of excitement. Here's a quote from Thomas Edison from 1931 extolling the virtues of solar energy. It only took 80 years for his words to come true, but the idea has been around for a long time, and the technology has worked for a long time. The product is a good product. Like wind and the other renewable resources, we don't have fuel price risk. We also have the technology itself, the equipment, is highly reliable. It's used, there was a photograph in the last slide of the Hubble telescope. Solar powers satellites, solar powers critical off-grid infrastructure, and it's solid state, and it works consistently day in, day out. Every single day you get production very reliably. In terms of how the grid sees the electricity coming online, it correlates very well with how we use power. Humans are more active in the daytime. That's when we produce energy, and so it's a more valuable energy product, even in some cases, than a flat product, depending on which market you're in. That's not always true, but it's a good energy product. It's also modular. We don't need to build at 100 megawatt scale. We can build reasonably economic projects in the sub 10 megawatt size range. So you can size those correctly and place them closer to where people live, where the electricity is used, and so there's less line losses and a more efficient system overall. So the last 3 or 4 years in the industry have truly seen awesome growth, and that growth has been driven largely by a steep decline in the price of the installed system. And this chart, the dotted line is the cost and the bars are the aggregate installed amounts in each year. It stops in 2013. Leading up to 2016, you'll see even more spectacular growth. That's partly because prices have continued to come down. Utilities are procuring energy, solar energy, at a very fast rate, and primarily in other markets, in the Southwest and the Northeast. Also, we have the federal tax credit, which we currently have a federal tax credit for solar. It expires at the end of 2016. So there is a drive and a push to get projects in the ground by the end of 2016. After 2016, for large-scale projects, the tax credit still exists, but it drops from 30% of installed value to 10%. So it's a significant moment for the industry in 2016. This slide I put in here just to show sort of the proportion of what's getting built in which markets, the green lines, are the green portions are utility scale projects, the blue is residential projects, and the orange is kind of everything else, commercial rooftop systems. And you see some very large projects coming in places like California and Nevada, where you might expect it. You see some very large projects coming online in places like North Carolina, where maybe you didn't expect it. And these are basically the state, nationally leading states for solar. So there's a question of whether solar is going to keep getting cheaper. My personal view is it will get incrementally better and cheaper, but we aren't expecting, as One Energy, an enormous leap in the next few years in technology. But incrementally, every aspect of solar project development is getting a little bit less expensive to install, and the product is getting a little better. Minor increases in solar panel efficiencies. The inverters are the technology that converts from DC to AC. More utility friendly, a little more efficient. The tracking systems that allow the panels to track the sun through the sky each day, more financeable. And there's more high quality contractors that are doing this at scale, and they're getting better at it, they're getting faster at it, and that's also bringing down the cost. Another big factor that doesn't always get mentioned is financial innovation in the sector and the lowering cost of capital that's available to solar projects. There are a couple of these are publicly traded entities that have formed really for an exclusive or primary purpose of owning solar assets, going to the public capital markets and promising really fairly low bond-like returns to investors. So that's a couple that I mentioned on the top half. SolarCity also is a big financial innovator. They're offering solar asset-backed notes that are also very low interest. So again, that's driving down the costs, the effective cost of energy from solar, because we're able to finance at a more effective price, at a lower price. So it starts to look like the cell industry, and the charts and graphs look a lot alike. So drilling a little bit into Oregon, we've got a pretty good resource in this state, especially when you get east of the mountains, as you know. Some of my developer colleagues in the audience may not agree with these numbers, but just for comparison's sake, what would we as a developer actually build on each side of the mountains, and how would it perform? On the west side, we would probably not build a tracking system. We'd probably build a fixed mount solar system. It would produce in the range, 1,300 megawatt hours a year-ish. Not quite enough sun to justify installing a tracking system. Whereas east of the mountains, you clearly could. You get both more sun, which is great, but you also can justify putting in a more efficient system. So you get, I say, 2,000 megawatt hours a year. Maybe it's a little less, maybe it's a little more. It really depends on specifics, but substantially stronger generation east of the mountains. And that is where most of the solar development at large scale is occurring in our state. So, how does this compare to other states, other leaders that I had on the prior slide? It's really pretty comparable to the Northeast. The west side of the mountains is pretty comparable to the Northeast, and the southeast part of the state is very comparable to most of California Central Valley. And so we've got a very good resource down there in the southeast, and we've got a very typical, from a national perspective, resource on the west side. We've got about 85 megawatts of solar installed here. Some of the other leaders, obviously California, New Jersey is a leader nationally, about 1,400 megawatts installed. Massachusetts has emerged with a very fast-growing industry as well. In the last quarter of 2014, New Jersey installed about what Oregon has ever installed. And I kind of chuckled at putting this slide up. Why would I compare us to New Jersey? Someone in the audience reminded me that you also can't pump your own gas there, so it's not so bad. don't take too much of this. I'm not advocating for us to become New Jersey, but it's an example of a very ambitious solar program in a relatively small state. And it's not only been effective and successful for the last 6 or 8 years, it's been expanded and strengthened through different administrations. The structure may or may not be applicable to Oregon, but it's an ambitious and successful program. So some of the challenges that we see in Oregon for our sector of the business is the power rates that we currently can get from utilities are very low because utilities are fairly long on power, as one of the last presenters mentioned, both because of the older coal-fired facilities and because we have hydro. And so our avoided cost prices that we can get from for the power are pretty low. Second point really has to do with, you know, energy market function. It got to some of the integration costs that was brought up, but there's not much that we as a Oregon alone can do about that. I feel our incentives are a little bit inconsistent between different solar system types, and we can do more to make the pie more expansive for all solar project types, meaning sizes and offtake strategies, whether you're selling to someone behind the meter on the roof, whether you're selling to a utility. We should treat those situations consistently. And there's some structures that we as a company are able to, or some strategies that we as a company are able to employ in other states that are really not available to us at all in Oregon. For example, customers, whether you're a university or a residence, cannot buy power from a remote system. You can buy power from a system on your roof, but you can't go to the market and procure solar or wind or others specifically. But you know, this current situation doesn't last forever. The hydro system is limited. The hydro system won't replace coal as it's phased out. Some of it will be phased out, not all of it. Cost for renewables currently is beating fossil. And I'll have a couple slides on that. And we've got a lot of great people in Oregon that are working hard on this. So, you know, where is the innovation happening in the sector? This is from Lazard, which is a financial advisory firm. It's been around for a long time. Currently, we compete very well. The utility scale numbers here presume a large project in the Southwest. But as you can see, we're pretty much on par with gas combined cycle. The high end of the gas combined cycle there was presuming they're paying for the cost of carbon sequestration. Next, another innovation is large projects delivering solar to large customers. This gentleman, despite his unfortunate football team choice, is building a project, one of our projects in Maryland. The output from this project will be delivered to the National Aquarium in Baltimore, about 50 miles away. This is a structure that the legislature directed the Public Utility Commission here in Oregon to study. There is a case ongoing at the commission. We don't know what the outcome is going to be. This may be something that's offered in the future in Oregon, but it's not something that we can practically do now. The other big innovation is larger projects delivering to small customers. Only maybe a third at most of residential customers can put a solar system on the roof for practical reasons. So community solar allows them to procure solar from a larger, efficiently built system away from their house. My last slide, people always ask us about whether we're putting batteries with our solar projects. The answer is no currently, but there's a lot happening here, and it's starting to feel a lot like the solar business, the way that batteries are being deployed. There's a mandate in California for utilities and for also independent parties to build out battery storage in that state. There's some financing of behind the meter, meaning like factories deploying batteries to avoid capacity charges from utilities. So there's growth in niche markets. And you know, person to watch here is this gentleman who's not in the next James Bond film. He's Elon Musk of Tesla, SolarCity, and SpaceX private rocket company. And he is very ambitious about batteries, building a huge battery factory in Nevada right now. And he intends personally and with his fortune to change how batteries are deployed. So interesting times will happen in this side of the sector. So with that, I'll stop my presentation. I do want to say briefly, I don't intend to further testify about legislation today, but for House Bill 2632, we do support the bill. We think it'll really drive the cost of solar in Oregon sharply down and result in a lot of projects getting built here. So with that, I'll turn it over to the next presenter. Thank you.
And the next presenter is also on solar, so we'll save questions for after that.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Just a keyboard, I think.
Oh, sorry.
Chair Vega, Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Israel. I'm with the Oregon Solar Energies Industry Association. I also own Sunlight Solar, a company in Bend. We have offices from our Oregon roots in Massachusetts and in Connecticut. Let's see what we got. This was an installation that I was a job site manager in 2002. It sits on the Capitol here. Since that time, we could build this system for probably half the cost, and it would have half the footprint on this roof. Boom. Costs have decreased dramatically. Approximately 10%, this is Energy Trust of Oregon data, so this is residential small commercial in Oregon. Costs have decreased approximately 10% per year. Panel and component prices have decreased. Soft costs have decreased pretty dramatically. The city of Portland lowered their permit fees, which is wonderful, and Oregon Department of Energy and the Energy Trust fused their computer system, which has now decreased my staff time by about 2 hours per customer on processing customers. It's fantastic. And also competition and experience has driven down costs in Oregon. Cost decreases mean incentives go much further. I just want to point down here, you can see in 2011, we installed about 1,200 systems. In 2014, we installed about 1,200 systems in Oregon, residential and small commercial. The cost for those incentives was $7.4 million, but here it's dropped to $4.7 million, and we even installed more. We're doing larger systems, and we're doing them less expensively. Oregon commercial, the funding went from $150 million to $1.5 million. That sector dropped off pretty dramatically. In Oregon, of course, we need a portfolio of installations to keep costs declining. We need residential, we need commercial, and we need utility scale. Oregon cumulative history, we have a huge milestone this year. We're actually hitting 100 megawatts. And OSEA members, I believe, are 90 to 95% of all that installation capacity, we're happy to report. And you can see also here, we've done a lot of utility, some utility, mostly small commercial, and then a lot of net metered or a lot of residential. Exciting portfolio mix, over 100 megawatts. 100 megawatt perspective, they're going to be retiring Pacific Power, this carbon plant in Utah, and it's 189 megawatts. So we've done 100 megawatts. We can replace that plant. We're also hitting a new milestone, 10,000 solar customers in Oregon. 10,000 solar families now have solar electric panels on their roof and small businesses. That money is staying in Oregon. 100 megawatts still drops us out of the top 10. At one point, we're in that top 10. You can see we more rank around Delaware down here. This is the cumulative solar capacity. They've done 53 megawatts. We're hitting 100 megawatts. And on a yearly basis, we're about 9 megawatts. We're about 23rd plus. 100 megawatts is a good starting point, but one-third of greenhouse gases are still from the electrical sector. And we can chomp into that with solar electricity. And do Oregons want to pay for solar? Is it worth it? Well, you can see this is a PGE report that shows the appetite for solar incremental costs in their electric bill to put solar on their families' homes would be about 3 to 5%. So if you want a number that's polling high, 3 to 5%. What are we doing? Right now we're doing about a little under 0.5%. And, of course, as soon as the contracts run out, the cost, the avoided costs here decreases pretty dramatically. But we could do more as a percentage for solar, and there's appetite for it financially. Why solar now? There's going to be a heck of a lot more energy usage. Data centers are coming online. Those are small cities, megawatt usage. Electric cars, marijuana, air conditioners, summer peaking. And this is a fascinating report from the PGE annual report. This shows that perhaps Oregon's becoming a summer peaking utility load. Who would have thought it? When I moved to Bend, no one had air conditioners. Everyone has air conditioners now. I would imagine in 2015 so far, we're going to have a hot summer. What does recent study show about solar? Community-owned solar, we talked about a little earlier. It allows all the other folks that want to go solar, they can now. Cost shift, that's been a big issue. Studies have proven that solar does not create cost shifts for solar customers to non-solar customers. In fact, studies have shown most solar customers cover the cost of the utilities to serve them. I have a feed-in tariff on my house. I still pay $40 to $60 a month for my utility bill. That covers the cost of delivering power to my home and to my neighbors. Net benefit. In fact, solar customers only pay for their share of, but also reduce the utility's cost to serve neighboring homes. Solar customers provide a net benefit to all ratepayers. This is a case study of Rhode Island, very similar to Oregon. They have a feed-in tariff and they have a state tax credit. It's a fascinating study. They're 98% gas-fired on their electric grid. You can see the problem with just being all gas-fired and why they want to diversify their portfolio in Rhode Island. Look at those CO2 emissions. You still get it. The study also showed, and it was a study that was required by the governor, the president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House in Rhode Island. The Brattle Group did it, really good. Economic impact output numbers up, employment up, state revenues up, rates long-term, price suppression. Actually, rates went down when you diversify your portfolio with solar. Case study, Rhode Island installation monies. We want to keep the monies in state. We have an incredible resource in Oregon. The largest solar plant in the Western Hemisphere is Solar World. It's wonderful. And you can see here in state, if you could move this 31% over, in state, 80% of your money stay in state when you do small scale installations and large scale installations. And here's Solar World. Interesting ETO data. In 2012, we peaked 60% of all residential and small commercial ETO Oregon installers installed Solar World modules. When I'm in the house in Oregon, folks want to use Solar World modules. And, of course, the solar industry has just outstripped the economy in job creation, 20 to 1. Why solar now? Load is growing. Summers are warming. Oregonians want solar and will pay for it. Install costs are decreasing. Solar is cost-effective and good public policy. We need residential, commercial, and utility scale. Final thought I'll leave you with. Solar will win out over fossil fuels. As solar is a technology. Solar technologies evolve. Just look on the top of this building and the changes that we've had in the last 15 years already. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative.
Yeah, I have a question for a couple of people, and I didn't catch your name.
It's Paul Israel.
Paul, thank you.
You're welcome.
You showed a lot of slides, and I was trying to see the dates on them, and they'd range from 2010 to 2014. So it was hard for me to follow and contrast and compare on those, and I was wondering if we don't have your presentation, I'm wondering if we can get it, and you can maybe put dates on all of them so we can follow along. If one thing is one thing to say it happened in this year, then you go back to this year, it was just hard.
Absolutely, thank you.
It just got put up too, so I thought it should be available in all this.
And then I did, if, Madam Chair, I have a question for Bill Eddy. And that is, you said hydro is limited, and I just wondered if you could define what you call hydro.
Chair Vega Pearson, Representative Boone, all of it. I think that my personal view is that the era of building large new hydropower dams is probably over. Best sites are taken. I think the agencies and the owners are doing the best they can to optimize what they have, and there isn't much room within the BPA system to serve additional loads. There's some utilities that are over their so-called high water mark now. That changes depending on your view of the water conditions, but I'm counting everything that's out there. I know some smaller facilities will get decommissioned or on track to do so, but you know, my view is the larger hydro system will stay in place.
Yeah. Quick follow-up. Thank you. So are you not counting wave then and tidal?
Oh, excuse me. No, I was not considering wave and tidal.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So under the Clean Water Act, the federal government stepped up and offers low-income loans or other types of credits to try to get our city's clean water systems up to speed. Under 111D rules and clean air rules, perhaps not quite as much electricity stepping up quickly to help. But they do give us this 30% credit, which is available for another this year, next year. Right. And that would be a means, I guess, of their attempting to spread the cost of their mandates out across the nation so that when we, if Oregon chooses to take advantage of this, can enjoy the benefits of that shared cost of this, shall we call it, required cleaner energy approach. Is that one of justification, now that I put all these words out here for you? Please say yes, that for the 30% tax federal tax credit.
Chair Baker-Peterson, Representative Benz. Yeah, I think that the root of the tax credits goes back to the 80s, and in our view, tax credits can be very difficult structure to work with. We don't, as a developer, as a project, don't necessarily get the full 30% value. It's diluted through the financing structures. But I'll just stop and say yes, it is part of the package. And I know that there's been federal budget discussions around extending the various renewable tax credits as part of some of the current administration's efforts. But what comes out of Congress is beyond me. So.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
The question is, and we've had this conversation in this room before about Oregon stepping on its own shoelaces and trying to take advantage of this type of opportunity for shared cost of this clean energy. And I say that because one of the bills I'm supporting is for larger utility scale solar. But the problem is we need big space to do it. And it takes longer to get to that big space because of the limitation on the amount of acres we can place these arrays upon. Longer, in fact, than perhaps through 2016. So it seems that we ought to be moving as quickly as we can if we're going to take advantage of that 30% federal input, because we have a number of hurdles we've imposed upon ourselves that we have to overcome. What I'm trying to say here is I think there's a reason we need to move quickly. Is that correct, or do you have faith in the possibility of an extension of that 30% input?
Chair Baker-Peterson, Representative Benz. Yes, we do feel urgency around the 2016 deadline. I think some people in the solar industry very firmly believe that we'll stick around and we'll be doing projects in 2017 and beyond, and in lots of markets, that's true. It will be a hit to lose that tax credit. What the bill does primarily is give us a glide path to ever lower solar prices in Oregon. The deployment of large-scale solar results in lower prices, both at a site-specific level and an industry-wide level. People get better at building stuff in Oregon. People get comfortable with our rules. The price will come down, and we're driving toward that, where it's where we don't need any subsidy, and it would be great if it was a level playing field for all resource types, fossil or other, but it's not. We hope to also extend the gentleman from the wind industry spoke about long-term revenues to landowners in rural areas. We pay lease rates, we pay property taxes. We want to extend those benefits around the state as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Keyboard. Yep. You know what?
Now
I want to switch.
Right.
Let's do that.
Go ahead and switch. And this one we do have. The other one isn't up yet, but we're going to get
that. I got
it. Oh, you did? Okay,
yeah,
great.
I got it.
Good.
Just had to go out of it and then back in.
Yeah. All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alex Sifford. My firm is Sifford Energy Services, and I'm speaking to you today on behalf of the geothermal energy industry in Oregon, chiefly represented by an outfit called the Geothermal Resources Council. And I'd just like to let the group know that back in October of this year, we had over 1,000 attendees worldwide for the annual geothermal industry meeting in Portland. And they took great advantage of it to see our wonderful geology. We seem to have shifted ahead here. Was I leaning on this the whole time? Good.
Wow, that's
great.
Right.
Okay, any questions?
One thing, I'm gonna flip it around a bit from my pitch here. It's very short, and that is, let me tell you that from the geothermal energy industry, we would like nothing more than to have a uniform federal tax incentive program, be it an investment tax credit or a production tax credit, that isn't fought over year after year. You heard from earlier speakers that their tax credit expires in 2016. Man, we're jealous. Ours expired 2 months ago. And again, it's an idiotic battle to have to go for it. One, I'd like to point out that the fossil fuel industry's tax credits are locked in permanently, never discussed. Anyway, enough of the complaining. What's more important is that Oregon has a terrific geothermal energy base. And I don't know how many folks are familiar with it, but depending on the water temperature, right beneath the Capitol building, there's enough energy to heat this building, using devices called geothermal or ground source heat pumps. Then again, there's hot springs. I think most representatives and senators have either hot springs resorts or other sorts of spa resorts in their districts. More importantly, in Oregon, we've been using that for well over 100 years. Klamath Falls is the big name in that regard, but it's not limited to Klamath Falls. And in addition to using it to heat buildings, people have been generating electricity now for, again, well over 100 years in other countries, and in California for close to that. In Oregon, the towns I've highlighted here on the map in red all have direct use or low temperature water in their communities that they're using. The locations in the black are all places that are generating power using geothermal steam or hot water, or they're exploring for it and very close to it. Direct use, again, piping water to heat a building. It's no joke to say in Klamath Falls you can go from birth to death in hot water. From the hospital through the nursing home with the brew pub in between and all the schools for your higher education. But it's not just limited to Kay Falls. Lakeview, Burns, Vail, until recently Vail had an operation where they made mushrooms using very hot water there. And again, that operation's no longer going on, but primarily due to mushroom business, not geothermal business. In Klamath Falls, besides heating individual buildings, there's a district heating system. And again, this is something that occurs in Boise, Idaho, San Bernardino, California, and Las Cruces, New Mexico. Again, if you're going to heat one building, maybe you could heat all of them. Klamath Falls also hosts OIT. Oregon Institute of Technology was way ahead of the curve in the early 60s, deciding to use hot water to heat the campus. And again, nobody here is old enough to remember, but oil was pretty darn cheap in the early 60s, and yet this was still a more viable alternative. And one thing that geothermal shares with all the energy resources that you've heard about today is keeping the money in the community. Gas may be cheaper to fire up that lumber mill, but you're sending a check to North Dakota at some point in the equation, and you're not keeping it in Marion County. With OIT, though, what's neat is beyond the geothermal heating the campus, which they've done for 40 years, they now started generating power using some very small modular power generation units. They've scaled up to their next largest size, this 1.2 megawatt, and then combined with a solar installation on the campus, that facility generates all its energy needs on campus. One of the first, I believe, campuses in the country to do so. Scaling up to utility scale, there's a project out in Ontario, in Malheur County, near Ontario, called Neal Hot Springs, developed by a company called U.S. Geothermal. It's a 22-megawatt project. It uses water that was actually identified by geothermal companies in the late 70s, and this is an indication of what's going on with the technology. Is in the 70s, Chevron Geothermal walked away from it, saying it's not super hot steam that we can just run right to a turbine. Therefore, it's not economic. We're walking away. This geothermal company comes along in the late 2000s and says, well, we think technology's finally caught up with it, and we can generate power using this relatively low-temperature water. The other thing that's interesting there is that they were selling the power to Idaho Power, the local provider in the area, but they also were wise enough to maybe engage Idaho Power to build the transmission line for them. So as we speak right now, the largest facility is Neal Hot Springs, and then another facility just about ready to start operation commercially is out in Paisley, in Lake County, and that's being built by Surprise Valley Electrification Co-op, and then two facilities at OIT. So in addition to this, there are other exploration prospects around the state, but this is what's online right now, the 35 megawatts. There's probably some interest in terms of CO2 emissions here, a little bit of a busy graph, but on the lines down near the bottom, you can see very little CO2 emissions from geothermal energy. Likewise, it has a footprint that's awfully small. So again, to develop a large scale facility requires not much more land than a small scale facility. I'd also point out there are incentives, but what's interesting is that these incentives apply to utilities in the Energy Trust territory or part of the Energy Trust group, the investor-owned utilities. That's fine. Statewide incentives, though, frequently help balance the playing field for projects and operations that are in consumer-owned utility territories. Last thing I'd like to point out is that there is a very cutting-edge research project going on in Central Oregon called Enhanced Geothermal Systems. And the company behind that, Altaroc, has managed to talk both the U.S. Department of Energy and Google out of some serious money to help back it as it explores something that they think, if it proves out, will be useful worldwide. And that is, where you find areas where you have high temperatures but not steam or hot water, is there a way to pump water down in there, capture that heat, bring it back to the surface, generate power, and again, do so without causing any unintended earthquakes or any unintended other consequences. And again, that project is ongoing at Newberry Volcano, just southeast of Bend. So again, right now we've got substantial direct use online, quite a variety of it, and I encourage you to go to your nearest Hot Springs resort when you have a chance at the end of the session. I suspect you'll need it. And we have a lot of other projects in progress right now. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Question for one of the other people.
Okay. Commissioner Rudin.
I think this might be for Paul. Just kind of wondering, if you were looking at the total potential for solar installations in the state, and you were doing an integrated resource plan for the entire state, what percentage would solar fill in the next 10 years, 15 years?
3 to 5%.
3 to 5%.
3 to 5.
Okay, hoping for a little bigger number than that. But okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
It could be bigger.
Bill,
this is for Alex, and you're almost my constituent. When I used to have Nesquin, yeah. Thank you for what you're doing. I missed where you said this Newberry project. Did you say Banff?
Like it. Correct, for just south of southeast of Bend is the Newberry Volcano.
Oh, Bandon.
Bend.
Banff, and I thought, yeah, I know they got hot springs up there.
So
okay, it's getting late.
It's more popularly known by Palina Lake and East Lake.
Okay, got it. Fishing. Thanks. Warm fish.
Yes. Bass. Yes, but
Let me try this again. So you said a smaller percentage than I was hoping for total solar installation. So is that the reason for that? Lack of land, high cost? Are we missing? Do we have a greater potential that could be reached under some circumstances?
If I may jump in.
Absolutely.
Chair Vicki Pearson, Representative Reardon. The IRP process is pretty complicated, and the modeling is pretty intricate. I think that if you're looking at 10 years out, we don't really have a land constraint. We may have a transmission constraint in some parts of the state that may not just be a question of the solar resource, but can we get the transmission to move the power to the right place? But you know, I would go higher than 5%. I would go 5 to 10, or even push it more over a 10-year term. And it also depends on how the market evolves with respect to coal retirements or not. Are those plants actually being phased out in part? And what does the price of natural gas do? If the natural gas price spikes due to exports or restrictions on fracking or any other reason, or just usage, solar and wind become extremely economic, and we just want to build it as fast as we can. So
Thank you all very
Thank
much
you.
For coming today. We appreciate that. I'm going to call up Kevin Bannister and Jason Bush.
He's hiding in the back.
Yeah, he's hiding.
Is that Bill?
Yeah.
Welcome. Go ahead and get started, and please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Bannister. I'm a vice president with a company called Principal Power, and we're the developer of a floating Offshore Wind Foundation. That's been tested and has been operating successfully offshore Portugal, actually, now for just about 4 years. But what I want to talk about today is a project that we have in development here in Oregon, and talk a little bit about the quality and quantity of the resource that we have off the west coast of the United States, and some of the opportunity that we think that represents for the state. So we're under development with a project called the WindFloat Pacific Project. It's a U.S. Department of Energy-supported demonstration project that's planned for a pretty significant distance offshore Coos Bay, actually about 18 miles due west of Coos Bay. What's really interesting here is that historically offshore wind has not been considered to be possible offshore the west coast, and that's largely because of the water depths. As you all probably know, the continental shelf is pretty close to the coast, and so the water gets very deep very quickly. But there are outstanding winds offshore the coast of Washington, Oregon, and California, truly world-class, especially in the sort of bottom half of Oregon and the northern half of California. And when I say world-class, I don't mean just strong winds, but they're also strong and consistent winds. So a colleague in the wind industry was mentioning capacity factors in the sort of 50% range from projects in Montana. We'd expect to see the same sort of performance from projects offshore Oregon in California. Our technology allows for the access of those resources because it's a floating technology. So projects can be sited in locations regardless of water depths and regardless of other potential conflicts that may exist in the offshore space. So to put a finer point to that, we're able to work closely with existing user groups, take into consideration areas that might have special ecological or environmental significance, and simply site our projects in locations that don't cause those conflicts, again, because these are floating structures. Off of Coos Bay, we're planning to deploy these structures, I mentioned, 18 miles offshore, but also in 1,200 feet of water. And this water depth is not a problem for the type of technology that we're deploying. I must apologize. I should have some images with me to help you visualize this thing. But functionally, what these look like are three columns with a wind turbine situated on one of the three columns. Originally, these technologies were established by the oil and gas industry. They're called semi-submersibles. They've been around and have been operated for decades. So there's not an awful lot of innovation left in that floating foundation. Where our company has created the greatest innovation is in marrying the aerodynamic loads that the wind turbine will experience and the hydrodynamic loads that the floating structure itself will experience. So through very, very sophisticated computer modeling, we now understand how this piece of equipment will interact under the incredibly dynamic conditions that you find offshore. An additional benefit, of course, for being located in deep water far from shore is that there's virtually no visual impacts. And with our project offshore Oregon, what we're planning to do is deploy up to 5 units with a project size up to potentially 40 megawatts. So what we're doing is deploying world-class, world-leading technologies in terms of offshore turbines. Vestas now has a turbine that's an 8-megawatt turbine, and it's possible that this project will be deploying those offshore Oregon. I mentioned that we have received significant support from the U.S. Department of Energy. Right now, we're in the second year of a financial assistance award from U.S. DOE. If we continue to be successful with this project, we'll have the opportunity, or Oregon will have the opportunity, to receive up to $50 million from the U.S. DOE. This is obviously important support as we look to really jumpstart the industry here on the West Coast with this project. In our view, Coos Bay and other coastal areas of our state stand to benefit tremendously from these projects and from the evolution of the industry, given, again, the proximity to this world-class resource in our state and in California. I mentioned that our first project was deployed in Portugal. That particular piece of equipment was towed 400 kilometers, 250 miles, from its fabrication site to the ultimate project site. We can envision the same sort of thing happening from Oregon's ports. What we do when we float these structures out is affix the wind turbine itself to the floating structure in the protected environment of the harbor, and then tow the fully assembled unit from that installation site to the project sites. This, of course, means that the tips, the very top of the wind turbine, can reach almost 600 feet. So what often when you're talking about marine type of work, you talk about draft and you want to know how deep something is. We actually go the other way. We are more worried about air draft. How high, what kind of clearance do we need from any structures between this assembly point and the project site? And bridges, of course, are what come to mind. So Coos Bay has an incredible advantage because of the infrastructure that's available there and the position of its bridge on the, call it the Atlantic side of its infrastructure. So we envision the potential for Coos Bay to become something like a deployment port of choice. And this is as the industry evolves, not only here, but also potentially to the south and to the north of us. This is particularly true because of what may be surprisingly we found to be some of the state's existing capacities that are incredibly relevant to offshore wind. There's Vigor Shipyards that has one of the largest dry docks in the Western Hemisphere. There's Vestas, I mentioned, the type of turbines that they're developing. I believe they're the world's leader in number of turbines installed offshore worldwide. And then our region's broad experience in wind. We have not only do we have developers like EDPR and some of our other colleagues who've been presenting today, but also DNVGL, which is an engineering and resource measurement enterprise, which is one of the world's leaders in that regard. So over the next couple of years, we're going to be continuing to work on the development of the project, and we hope to see offshore wind taking on a more meaningful stake in Oregon's resource mix. There's the tremendous potential to do this, and we think that the project that we started in Coos Bay will be the critical first step towards the establishment of the industry. I'd be excited to take questions in a few moments.
Well, Jason, go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Jason Bush, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust, OWET. I submitted a one-pager of information for you. It has some highlighted information about some of the things happening in our industry beyond what I'll comment upon today. OWET is a nonprofit that's funded by the Oregon Innovation Council, which utilizes lottery dollars to invest in industries that have the potential to have significant returns on investment for the state. Over the years, Oregon Innovation Council has invested in organizations such as Oregon Seafood, the food processors, OWET. I think their most recent one is the unmanned aerial vehicles effort. Over the past 8 years, OWET has used our funding to work to make Oregon the national leader in ocean energy, and we are that by all standards. We have, in the course of the studies and support for research and development and building of the supply chain, helped create or retain about 60 jobs in Oregon. And we have leveraged about $30 million of private and federal money to support the ocean energy industry. We are really just in the very earliest stages of ocean energy. I think of all the technologies you've heard about today, we are truly the most only pre-commercial technology, probably 3 to 5 years before you'll see the first commercial projects go in the water. The benefits that we're seeing currently are just a function of the research and development phase that we're currently in. We certainly would like to see this industry move into the commercial deployment phase and ultimately become a mature industry where we would hope to realize the most significant returns on investment of the state's dollars.
The way that OWES supports this industry is essentially by reducing barriers to entry for the various companies that are coming to Oregon and promoting research and development. Each project that we fund, we select because we think it will be something that helps lift the entire industry, not just specific companies or technologies. The work that we do is paving the path and reducing barriers to entry for this industry and making it easier for every subsequent developer to do a project here. That includes the environmental studies work, we have done, the permitting work we've worked on for example, the territorial sea plan, and helping to set up the testing infrastructure in this state. We've focused on ocean energy for a variety of reasons. Oregon is really uniquely positioned to take advantage of this nascent industry. It starts with the resource that lies off our shores in the entire Pacific Northwest is tremendous. It's limited really by the technologies and our willingness to put devices into the water, the public acceptance of those technologies. It is a form of west side generation, offsetting and balancing a grid that is primarily fed from the east, almost exclusively fed from the east, as far east as is Washington, of Wyoming and Montana. That helps alleviate many of the problems you see out on the coast with essentially a long extension cord ending down in the south coast of Oregon, where the quality of the power has had issues for several years and has required a fair amount of investments to improve the quality of that power. It also provides generation on the coast where they have experienced very real lost opportunities with companies that wanted to do projects in Oregon, manufacturing data centers that simply did not have adequate capacity to power their needs. The alternative is to build generation on the coast or to build transmission across the coast range. Obviously, ocean energy is a low-carbon energy source. It's also highly reliable and highly predictable. We are certainly well aware of the many issues associated with integrating variable resources. Some of the work we've done at OWET has demonstrated that ocean energy will cost a lot less than some of the other resources to integrate into the grid. In fact, just in a timely note here, there's a study that just came out of Oregon State University, Integrating Ocean Wave Energy at Large Scales, a study of the U.S. Pacific Northwest. I brought a couple of these if any of you are truly gluttons. I'll leave that with you and you can read about that study. That work was done by Oregon State University professors and some folks who have been working in our industry for the last few years and begun to develop the expertise and knowledge to write this kind of article, and it continues to demonstrate why Oregon is the national leader in this industry. It also is important to consider the as we look into the future, portfolio diversification is going to always remain an important aspect of any energy infrastructure. As was commented earlier, the money that's invested in ocean energy stays in Oregon because the generation is here and the companies will be here that will be building the devices, which are very large. They will not be imported from some other country or across the country. They'll be built in places like Vigor Industries and Oregon Iron Works. So that keeps the dollars in Oregon. But to be clear, I personally think that ocean energy will have limited penetration as an energy source for Oregon, at least in our careers. In the next 20 years, we'd like to see maybe 500 megawatts of generation in Oregon. We picked that number because that's the capacity on the grid on the Oregon coast. We've done the research, and we realized that we can bring that much power onto the grid without any major infrastructure upgrades to the Oregon coast grid. But the goal there is not to initially be a large part of our energy portfolio, but rather to sort of to apply the Danish model for wind, as we will do for wave. We would like to have early, as we have seen, and continued support for ocean energy, allow it to develop here with research and development, and have limited penetration, but reap the rewards in the long term of having significant resources coming back to Oregon, as Denmark has experienced with wind. Kevin mentioned Vestas Energy, for example. They have a small portion of the world's installed capacity, but they bring in well over half of the revenue associated with this industry for the companies that developed there. We'd love to be able to tell that story for Oregon about wave energy. I cannot stop without mentioning the Northwest National Marine Renewable Energy Center, NMREC. It's a mouthful. To make it even better, there's also SMMREC and HMREC. But we have NMREC here in Oregon, and it is the flagship research center located at Oregon State University. It is funded by the Department of Energy. They recently computed how much money they have received over the last few years doing ocean energy-related research and development, and it's about $44 million. That organization continues to grow. We work very closely with NMREC, and we're currently in the process of building what we call the South Energy Test Site, which will be the nation's first grid-connected, fully energetic test site for technologies that are approaching commercial viability. It'll be the final demonstration site for those technologies. And I'll stop there, and I'm happy to take questions.
Representative Vice Chair Rudin.
Thank you for coming. I really, Jason, really enjoy getting an update on the wave energy. haven't followed this for a little bit. Last time we talked, there were several kind of competing technologies on methods for generating electricity. Is that sort of starting to narrow down to a few winners, or?
I think that, well, we've certainly had a few losers. Some of the first-generation technologies that started 10 or 15 years ago have simply gone away, as they should have. They were early pioneers. Their technologies were not as efficient as some of the more modern versions, and they've gone away, and they've sort of been high-profile failures, to be expected. What you have in ocean energy is a lot of different sectors. You have utility scale, you have, say, commercial or community scale projects, you have areas like the Caribbean, you have areas like Alaska, you have a highly energetic area like Oregon. All of those areas would need or be able to use different types of technologies. So there are many different companies looking in these different market niches. One of the companies that I think is doing quite well is an Oregon-based company, Columbia Power Technologies. They're looking at the full utility-scale projects like Oregon would be able to host. They're currently working with Siemens. They're integrating Siemens generators into their device. Those generators, to give you an idea of scale, are about 6 meters in diameter, and these devices will put out about a megawatt of generation. I think they're a world leader. We're lucky to have them as an Oregon-based company. But as you well know, Representative Reardon, there are several other companies that are located in Oregon that are also doing quite well in their respective niches.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate your testimony. We've heard a lot. As you can see, the renewable energy, all the different renewable energy sources in Oregon, we are rich, I think, in a lot of upcoming technologies. And so appreciate everyone who came in here today. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the informational hearing on renewable overview. And we have some folks who have traveled for the next bill. So I'm going to open the bill, but carry over most of the testimony until Thursday, but we will go ahead and for those folks who have traveled to be here, go ahead and get them. So I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2632. And Representative Vence, I'm going to have Beth go ahead and introduce the bill and then have some of your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2632 would direct the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to establish a program to incentivize the generation of electricity derived from solar energy. There's no revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact, and there's a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, since I have to leave at 5,
okay.
I think it would be best if we went ahead and took whatever testimony we can, and then I'll be happy to talk more.
On Thursday?
Yes.
Okay, that sounds great. So let's go ahead and call David Brown and Dave Markham down to testify.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
Would you like to go first?
Okay.
Fine.
Go ahead. Excuse me. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Brown. My company is Obsidian Renewables. With the shortness of time, I think it's important that we let Mr. Markham go. He drove over from Bend.
Mm-hmm.
And I have probably more to say than just a few minutes that Mr. Bence has available, Representative Bence has available will allow. So I'm going to give my testimony Thursday, and we'll turn to Dave Markham. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. My name is Dave Markham. I'm the president and CEO of Central Electric Cooperative, headquartered in Redmond, Oregon. I'm also the president of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, and we represent the state's 18 not-for-profit electric cooperatives. So let me start, because I'm glad, I appreciate you letting me have the time to visit. I'm very excited about what Central Electric is doing in regards to community solar. Let me just take you back. Last couple of years, we've been educating our members about community solar, just over time surveying them, finding out their interest, and they've continued to tell us that they're interested in being involved in community solar project. And so, as of now, we're planning on moving forward with breaking ground sometime late this summer on 2 100-kilowatt community solar projects. They'll be located at our office in Bend, and we expect that they'll be completed by the end of the year and producing power. And there's other electric co-ops throughout the state that are also in various stages of development of community solar, but I do believe that we'll have the first project of any utility as far as a community solar that will be up and running. And so why community solar? If you look at community solar, you look at, you've heard about the rooftop solar units that you see when you drive down the street. You've heard some of the statistics. Up to 75% is a statistic I've heard of people that would like to have solar, but because either the initial cost is too much, they can't afford to have it on their house, maybe they don't own their house, or they live in an apartment, or the orientation of the home isn't proper, they have shade, and so solar doesn't work. But our community solar program, it's going to be able to accommodate anybody that wants to participate. It doesn't matter their income level, if they own a home, or if they live in an apartment, or orientation, because it's sited in one central location at our Bend office. And because of that, we achieve some economies of scale with price. And what's really exciting for the consumer is that we take care of maintaining it also. They don't have to worry about that. Over the last couple months, I've had several discussions with Mr. Brown about some opportunities that I believe there are to accelerate solar development in rural Oregon. And what I recommend in the bill with its current language right now, there's a threshold of 2 megawatts or 2,000 kilowatts for participation in the program. What I'm recommending for consumer-owned utility service territory is that we look at decreasing that to 100 kW limit. And in this really, a lot of ways, it makes more sense for rural Oregon, because as rural utilities, we don't have the population or the loads that investor-owned utilities do in the state. And so an incentive program like this, it can help reduce the total cost of a project. And what that does is that it makes ability for people to participate higher. Knowledge grows as people participate, acceptance grows, and in turn, I believe that you'll see a larger demand for solar energy in the future. And while the incentive program in its current form is bill, it's appealing to a lot of co-ops like Central Electric. There are some other co-ops that, by being able to receive an incentive up front, it would decrease the cost of installation. And one other item, different subject, and this is on safety. And safety, it's by far the highest priority to our employees, to our consumers, and to the public. And I've recommended that we add some language in the bill that would require any interconnection of a solar system into utilities infrastructure, that it has to follow the procedures of interconnection that have been established by that utility, and that's for safety reasons. And so Mr. Brown, in my discussions, he's expressed his support for these recommendations, and I'm confident that these recommendations, that they will create an opportunity for more solar energy development, especially in rural Oregon. So with that, I'll stop, Madam Chair, and any questions that the committee may have, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Thank you so much for traveling so far to share your experience with us. Are there questions? No.
All that way and no questions.
Well, no.
That's fine.
No, I appreciate your time and your thoughtfulness in looking at the bill and talking about how we can use the program to really match what's needed in the rural communities. In terms of incenting solar development out there, and as well as the some of the safety mechanisms that you were talking about, making sure that we have those.
Yeah.
So,
thank you, Madam Chair. I'll send the committee pictures when we break ground.
Mm-hmm. All right. Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
Good question. I appreciate our rural electric co-op folks so much. I'm privileged to live in one and think of a world of Ted. But I do appreciate your practical approach, which, frankly, I find sometimes it's refreshing this conversation. But I think, especially as you look at the top of page 2 and hear what you say, the National Renewable Energy Lab reports that up to 75% of American households are unsuitable for hosting solar PV systems due to shade, orientation, structural factor, or ownership issues. So that's not a perspective we oftentimes hear, but you're looking for a way to make folks able to participate in that, even though their home may not be a suitable location.
Right.
So hats off to you guys for thinking about this, and I hope we can work with you.
Thank you very
Appreciate
much.
Appreciate it.
Representative. All right.
Representative Colby.
Just real quick about the incentive part of that and where the funding mechanism for that incentive comes from. Does it come from the ratepayers that are in this utility district, or is it coming from the taxpayers of Oregon?
For the funding of the project so that we can...
In House Bill 2632.
Oh, in House Bill 26... I believe that comes from the general fund, doesn't it?
Yes, from the general... Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Can you state your name? Thank you.
David Brown, yes. Would come from the general fund, Representative Holvey.
And I guess follow-up, I'm just wondering, what the calculus for that as opposed to having it funded by the ratepayers of that particular district where the facility would be located.
Chair Vega Peterson and Representative Holvey, as far as our we have this set up to where it's not being funded. The project isn't being funded by all of our ratepayers. Those that want to participate in the project are the ones that are funding it. We have about 1,000 member consumers right now that are participating in our Green Power program, and we anticipate that those will carry over with our solar project, which part of it is 100 kW is Green Power. And so just the ones that participate are the ones that are funding the project. It's not spread through our whole rate base.
Right. So, but that's different than what's proposed in 2632.
But, yeah, Chair Vega Pearson, Representative Holden, this would be, to my knowledge, an additional, this would be an incentive for us. It would come back and would benefit those that are participating in the program. So, yes, they would be seeing the direct benefit, not our entire membership, but those that are helping fund the project would see the benefit from the rebate participating in the program.
Okay, thank you so
much again for being
here, David. I'm going to go ahead, as I said, I'm going to carry this bill over until Thursday. So for now, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2632. And if there's nothing else for the good of the order, I'm going to go ahead and close the meeting on the House Energy and Environment Committee. House Energy and Environment Committee.